Oh, you know, we did promise you ahead of time that there's so many gadgets and gizmos.
We'll try to refrain ourselves from, like, pushing buttons while we're up here.
Don't touch the buttons, please.
Hi there, I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Kathy Bernard. This week on Two Boomer Bays, is the annual physical becoming a relic of the past?
We'll get advice from an expert.
Next, a mother-daughter duo charms audiences with humor and song.
Cruising on the Rhine, our convo with the captain.
It's surfing every ocean on your bucket list. We'll talk with a guy who actually did it.
Finally, we'll shoot the breeze about the marriage of cycling and bar hopping. Partying on a bike on steroids, built for 16. For many Americans, the annual physical exam is a dreaded ritual. Not only are we weighed, yikes, but we're also subjected to a huge battery of screening tests. This is the more is better approach to healthcare. But do we really need all those tests and every year?
Dr. Christine Castle is the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation. It's joined forces with Consumer Reports, and they've come up with a list of basic medical tests and procedures that are often performed but may not be necessary. The project is called Choosing Wisely. Dr. Castle joins us on the phone from Santa Fe. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I always thought that the more tests I have, the more likely it is some horrible disease will be caught and then it can be treated early. And if all those tests come back negative, I feel great. So what's wrong with that mindset, Dr. Castle?
What's wrong with that mindset is two things, and actually probably more than two things. But the first one, from the patient's perspective, is that the tests that aren't necessary sometimes actually have risks in and of themselves. For example, radiation risk with various kinds of x-rays, particularly if you get lots of them. The second thing is that sometimes every test is not perfect. So sometimes there are incidental findings or there is something that might look a little unusual that might lead to a large number of additional tests, some of which can be invasive, some of which can have greater risks, and it may turn out that you never needed that in the first place. And then the third reason is that increasingly patients and consumers are paying more out of pocket for medical care, and often these costs are really unnecessary costs or real waste in our healthcare spending.
Really, what is the downside of overscreening? Besides, you know, having false positives, and it's just the cost and the false positives really
The false positives and the costs really outweigh the benefits that you get from it. In some ways, particularly the idea that a lot of these medical tests are reassuring to people that now I know I'm healthy so I don't have to worry about it anymore. In fact, what research shows is that it's actually more effective for patients to see their doctor. It's important to have a relationship with a primary care physician, so I want to emphasize that. And to see their doctor when you think you're having problems rather than to put everything on this test that happens kind of at arbitrary intervals. Now, I do want to say, though, that the idea of an annual visit to a physician, particularly if you're a healthy person, may not be because you need to have a lot of tests and exams. It may be more important to actually get counseling about your health and about your weight. I noticed you mentioned that at the beginning
of
this.
Oh, you noticed, Dr. Castle.
Well, these are things that weight, smoking, alcohol use, other kinds of health hazards that really require a conversation with the doctor. Also, you know, for older patients, looking ahead at advanced care planning or other kinds of questions they might want to have for their doctor. So the relationship building part of it actually is important. And I think over the years, we've replaced that with, oh, I just need to check the boxes on all these tests and then I'm okay. And it's in fact that the conversation is more important than the test usually.
You know, I do think it's a challenge, the relationship building, because of the time constraints of the physicians these days.
And that leads to one of the questions about how does this change how we think about physician practice? Because there are ways in which physicians get paid in our traditional healthcare system called fee-for-service, where they don't really have time. They aren't really paid to sit down and have a conversation with you. They only get paid if they send a bill for a test. So it's come to kind of replace that in a way. And in fact, research shows that the tests are less valuable than the conversation. So because of that, both the innovations in Medicare as well as in the private sector healthcare plans have been trying to find different ways of structuring how they pay doctors. Sometimes what's called global payment or a monthly fee that the doctor would get paid to try to keep patients healthy. Those kinds of innovations, I think, we're going to be seeing more and more of for exactly that reason.
Well, Dr. Kissel, we'd like to get your take on some of these common screening tests that you're talking about and see whether or not you think they're necessary, and if so, how often. Let's start with the Pap smear, which tests for cervical cancer. And in the past, I mean, we women were encouraged to get it every year. Is that still the same thinking?
It's not necessary every year. Most of the current research shows that if it's normal, if you're, and all of this, when we're talking about screening, we're talking about somebody who's a healthy person with no symptoms. So, of course, if you're having any kind of symptoms, then that changes what your doctor needs to do for you. But if you're a healthy woman, then every 2 years, and some people even think every 2 to 3 years is okay. If you have higher risk factors, and you know those, your gynecologist can tell you what those are, then you might need to have it more frequently.
Is menopause a high risk?
No, actually, exactly the opposite.
Oh, good.
After,
there's an upside to it.
Right. After menopause, and as women get older, the gap can go sometimes to every 5 years. And after 70 or 75 years of age, probably you don't need to have it anymore.
We are speaking with Dr. Christine Kissel about the ritual of the annual physical exam and the potentially harmful effects of overscreening. Dr. Kissel, what about the dreaded squeeze, the mammogram? We always look forward to that, don't we, girls?
Well, you know, the mammogram recommendations are still for annual mammograms, at least for women over 50, and but less frequently, again, as we get older, if they have been normal and if you don't have any particular risk factors like family history of breast cancer, having been on hormone replacement for a significant period of time, or things like that. So again, I think it's part of what people think when they think of screening. Screening is really something that, you know, affects everybody broadly and doesn't really focus the care on what you need for that particular patient. But having an annual mammogram, or every 2 years if that's what your doctor recommends, doesn't require that you go to the doctor to have a visit. So when you think about the issue of the efficiency and sort of the best use of patients' times and best use of doctors' times, if you can schedule those things yourself and, you know, having more access to your own electronic health record would help that a lot, then you can go ahead and have them. Patients should be empowered to do that without needing to have the annual physical be the trigger for that test.
Okay, and then the bane of many boomers is the colonoscopy. And
yes,
I wish that, they'd
that,
come up with some other
stuff.
That's
less favorite than anything. Right?
So how often do you recommend that?
Well, again, that's getting to be a 10-year, 5- to 10-year cycle that unless they find something that looks like it's precancerous or you have some risk factors that need to be looked at sooner, in which case coming back sooner. But 10 years is really, for people who have no risk factors and no findings on their last one, is probably the best interval.
Now, is there any other prep invented these days besides drinking that horrible stuff?
That delicious orange-flavored
mine was
gunk
green.
Well, not to mention what it does to you. Right?
I know.
Yeah. Well, there are some new technologies that are coming on the market. They aren't widespread yet, but that are very promising for having a more non-invasive approach to colon cancer screening. But, you know, I don't want to underestimate the importance of doing this screening, particularly in different minority groups, for example, where not enough people get screened and where colon cancer really is a major health risk and survival risk and cause of death. So your listeners should not think that these tests aren't important, because they really can pick up early colon cancer. It's just that you don't need to. Once you've had one, you need to have that first one when you turn 50. But once you've had that, then your doctor can tell you, do you need to have it in 5 years, do you need to have it in 10 years? And that period of time is what we're continuing to study to see how often or how little one really does need to have it.
Okay, what about the PSA test, which screens for prostate cancer? It's really controversial these days.
That's very controversial, and it's more complicated. Now, it's not the boomer babes, of course, who are interested in these. It's the boomer dudes, but the boomer babes care about the boomer dudes, right?
Of course.
And it's very important, frankly, for women are often the people who make the healthcare decisions in the family. And so I think women want to be educated about the importance of PSA testing. The problem with PSA testing has to do with what I mentioned earlier on in our general conversation, which is that it very often picks up things in a prostate gland that either aren't cancer, and then a patient goes through invasive biopsies that can be painful, can be very expensive, and that aren't necessary, or it picks up cancer at a very early stage, which isn't a life-threatening cancer. And that's something that's very hard for Americans to really understand, because we've been drilled to think cancer is just always the most terrible thing that could happen to you and you've got to get rid of it. But prostate cancer comes in a wide variety of severities, and severe prostate cancer can be life-threatening and needs to be attended to, and you can tell that if you watch it and you do that biopsy at the right point. But most of those early cancers are often cancers where people could live 15, 20, many more years with the cancer and not die of that, die of something else, particularly if they get it at older years. And the problem is that the treatment that men get for prostate cancer comes with really severe side effects. Loss of control over urine and erectile dysfunction, which really impact the quality of a man's life. And so their shared decision-making in those instances really is important, where the man really needs to make their own decision about what should I have this or not.
Well, and Dr. Castle, we could go on and on, but unfortunately we're out of time. Dr. Christine Castle, President of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, thank you so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
It was really a pleasure, and I'm really glad that you're going to have this show.
Up next, a mother-daughter duo charms with humor and song. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Years ago, while enjoying a night out on the town, Kathy and I discovered an amazing new talent, Kat Parsons. Her voice and sense of humor captivated us. We've been fans ever since and have watched her career absolutely explode.
Over the years, at various concert venues, an amazing boomer musician would join Kat on stage. They would perform to the delight of their audiences. Who is she? It's Kat's mom, Julie Parsons. Julie is a professional musician in her own right, and they both join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome, ladies. We're so glad you're with us.
We're so glad to be here.
We certainly are.
Well, Julie, both you and your husband are professional musicians. You sing and play the piano, and your husband is also an opera singer. I mean, for Pete's sake, we're lucky we can play the radio. How did you meet? Tell us quickly.
Well, I met my husband at Northwestern University, where I was getting my undergraduate degree in music and voice. And he was a graduate student, and actually he taught me voice in my senior year. He was my teacher, and I got an A+.
Oh, I bet you did.
That year, in my voice lessons.
Is that legal? I don't know.
Right. Maybe we shouldn't ask.
Okay, yes. Well, then Kat happened along, and we understand she had a first gig rather early at the age of 5. Is that true?
That is true. My mom was playing at a hotel and invited me onto the bench. She did not have to coax me. It took about 30 seconds for me to arrive and about 5 minutes for her to get me to leave the bench. But yeah, I sang a song and she let me keep all the tips, and someone gave a $20 bill, and I was just like,
wow.
I mean, that was exciting.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, at 5 years old, that's insane.
You sang Somewhere Out There. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah,
and you were in a little striped pinafore. Do you remember that?
No.
Okay.
I just remember the $20.
Oh, gosh. I think you were.
And the applause.
Yes, the applause. That's what you like.
So is that when you really got the bug, so to speak?
You know, I don't know. I think it's kind of, I partially think it's genetic, that I just love music so much. It's so much a part of who I am. And I think that's because it's always been in the house. My grandparents, my mom's dad and mom love music. My dad's parents were in a band. My dad's sisters are choir conductors. My mom's sisters were singers and dancers. So it's just kind of been very natural for to have that. It's just been around in the house. I mean, we harmonize to the clock chime in our house. And
I was thinking you all sound like the Sound of Music, you know,
except that we fight a little bit more.
Yeah. Hey, you took my part.
Hey. Julie, do you have a whistle where you call them downstairs and they come running?
Yeah.
I wish.
Are they all in harmony?
Well, we did get in harmony, but that was after the arguing about who got which part. But ultimately, we found the harmony.
Mm-hmm. And then, Kat, you studied theater at Northwestern, which is a fabulous place. Did this help to develop your stage presence? Or, I mean, you're not exactly a wilting violet, so I think it could have helped.
I think it did, yeah. I think that that training just further prepared me for being on stage and being comfortable on stage. And I've always loved talking with people from stage and always have been pretty comfortable with that. But I think the acting definitely added a new dimension of understanding the workings of a show and how to put on an entertainment. Oh my gosh.
Venue.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Well, how did you all really start singing together? I mean, obviously when your family gets together, I would love to be a fly on the wall for that one. You know, good morning. You just chime into song.
Pretty much, actually. It's you know, my dad has even woken us up with a trumpet before.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, pretty much there's just, I would say everyone is always singing. And my mom, you're also playing piano a lot. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. As I grew up, you were doing a band called Foxfire, which mm-hmm. was kind of a rock band. And she was kind of coming in at late nights. And
in my spandex. That was the
days.
Spandex and big hair.
Oh, yeah. And shoulder pads.
And exactly.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So was this an all-girl band?
This was an all-girl band.
Oh, cool.
And Kat and the neighborhood friends really enjoyed dancing to our Foxfire songs and sort of being pretend Foxfire girls.
We dressed up. My favorite piece of clothing of hers was zebra leggings and fishnet stockings that you put on your arms.
Oh, very creative.
Oh my.
You must have been the coolest mom in the neighborhood.
Well,
a rock star as a mother.
I don't know, but it was very quickly after Kat was starring in my shows, and then it flip-flopped into Kat had all the cool shows, mm-hmm. and then she has invited me to play with her which I absolutely love, love, love doing.
Well, I have to tell you, girls, here's a confession. I had a girls' band. Did you know that, Barbara?
No, I never did.
Oh, what was your name?
I did. Oh, we were so unbelievably talented. I was 12, and we were called the Mini Skirts.
Oh, very cute.
And what did you play?
Oh, we had, like, you know, one or two. We didn't play. We just sang.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You sang and danced. Awesome.
Yes, we did. We would harmonize. You know, we kind of had a little show.
Right. And anytime I tried to sing, I would always hear, "Shut up," in the background. It was not a pretty sight. Well, this is the Two Boomer Babes, and we are chatting with mother-daughter musicians Julie and Kat Parsons, and when we come back, we'll find out what it's like to perform with your daughter or your mom, and we'll hear a bit of their musical magic. We'll be right back after the break.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6 I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6 I make his breakfast. At 7 I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes. We're continuing our discussion with mother-daughter singer-songwriters Julie and Kat Parsons.
We are in for a big treat. You are both going to sing for us, and tell us about the particular song you're going to sing.
The song we're going to sing is called Harder Than It Is, and I always like to introduce this song. You know, my mom is now a social worker, is in psychotherapy, and so she's been what I call therapizing us our whole lives, which fits with the artist, you know, the artist and the emotions. And so she wrote me this email with the lyrical idea for this song, and I turned it into the song that we're going to sing.
Why do you have to make it harder than it is? Baby, just you might learn things you never know. 'Cause you got your eyes closed, and you've been working this all night. Rub it, roll your own bare head.
Tell us, what is it like to perform with your mom, Kat?
It's wonderful. You know, I feel so supported and encouraged by her, and having someone else who kind of knows me so well and can tell when, I mean, I don't know if other people have this experience, but when I look at my mom, I know what she's thinking, and when she looks at me, she knows what I'm thinking. There's no hiding anything from my mom. And so on stage, to have that kind of support for someone who knows you so well, who can tell how you're feeling about something, is really wonderful.
Or if she needs to chime in and help you out or whatever, pick
yeah.
you up.
Yeah. Well, you know the looks, too. Nothing's
yeah.
like a mother's look
oh,
that you
yeah.
just know.
Well, do you all ever worry that the audience will actually prefer one of you over the other? I mean, are they just charmed by you both, which I think is the case.
Kat is such a wonderful, of course, this is the mother talking, but she's such a wonderful singer. And such a funny storyteller that I just feel like I'm sort of the support person, and if I can provide accompaniment and some background vocals, she just takes the show away. So for me, it's just a pleasure because I get the easy part and she does the hard part.
And so of course, I don't think of it that way. I think of it as, I mean, I'm really lucky because there's not competition between us. There's a lot of love and support, and we both want each other to do so well. On different things, and we're both so self-critical, so she'll say, oh, I sounded terrible in this. Mom, you did not. You sounded wonderful. What are you talking about? And then I'll say, but man, that story really bombed, and she'll be like, I thought it was funny.
Exactly.
It's all perspective, right?
Exactly.
Right? Actually, we do quite a bit of that, you know, between the two of us as well. And Kat, speaking of successful, you have launched a new CD. And what's the name of the new CD?
Well, the most recent one is called Oh, and it has kind of my first happy love songs, is what I call it. The first time I've ever written something nice about a relationship. So it was a very exciting boundary for me to break. And I'm really enjoying that. And then I'm going to have a new one coming out, the third one of the series coming out in this year.
Where do you want your career to go next?
I would like to, for my career, to have enough. I'd like, you know, always as an artist, you're always wanting your audience to grow. You're always wanting to connect to more people, to be able to connect to more people, to know that more people are listening to the music, that they're getting something out of it. And then with that comes the possibility of being able to reach more people and being able to do some sort of social work along with that.
Well, Julie and Kat Parsons, mother, daughter, singer, songwriters, you both are really amazing and a great inspiration to us babes. Thanks so much for sharing your great story and singing for us. We hope to see you on tour.
Thank you.
Why do you have to make it harder than it is?
Up next, Going to Extremes, the real-life adventure of surfing every ocean and climbing the highest peak on every continent. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
And I are enjoying quite the adventure on a Viking launch ship, Edom. We began our journey in Prague, and we're now in the middle of the Moselle River in Germany. We're chatting with our uber wonderful captain, Johann Bons, in the wheelhouse of his ship. Captain Johann, what a great gig you have. I mean, after all, we think, you know, there are many things worse than cruising the rivers of Europe for a job.
It's a terrible job. Yeah.
Terrible job, but somebody's got to do it, right? So how did you get into the captain business?
That's an easy question. My father was captain too, so I grew up on the ship.
Yeah. So as a little toddler?
No, my mother lives on land, and my father has a boat, an employee boat, so I'm not really, really lived on the ships like some Dutch children do. I lived on land, but my mother, I'm one of six, so my mother was always pleased in the school vacations to send one of the children to the ship, Papa. And that was always me.
Oh, so it's in your blood.
Probably. I spent 15 weeks a year on the ship. And
yeah. You love it.
Yes,
you
know, now I love it, yeah.
After many years.
Now when you're young, you think, is this the living I want? And my father worked much, much harder than me. There was not so much comfort at the time. Yeah. So, but now it's great. And I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I try 1 year office. And I'm happy I was able to go back to the...
Yeah.
To the water.
So I taste the other side as well a little bit.
And so you must have nice crew quarters.
Yeah, of course. We have a jacuzzi and a swimming pool and everything.
Oh, we want yours. Room service.
When you go down to the basement, that is the real 5-star.
Oh, yeah.
Now, space is limited on this kind of ships, and our cabins are limited. But like you say in the hotel, you're just there to sleep and to shower.
Right.
But they are clean and efficient.
Yeah.
Well, Captain, we've noticed that we've gone through many, many locks, and we are just amazed at the precision that you all, I mean, that there's no bumping, you just do it so well. So how do you navigate all these locks?
Practicing.
Practice makes
the first
perfect.
One is very bad, and the second one too. That's not the locks that you try to remember, but after 200-300 pieces, it's going better. And there are small tricks, of course. Small ideas. And the ships, they have excellent maneuver skills. The ships are built to go in those locks.
Do they have bumpers on the side?
They are bumpers, yes.
Oh, that's okay. That helps.
Yeah, but they're a little bit tired. You get new bumpers in the winter.
Yeah.
Now, what about during peak season when there's more boats on the rivers? Is it more difficult to navigate?
It can be, yes. When it's been very busy, then you have to... that's experience. When you have a lot of ships, then you have to notice and know and guess what the intentions are from the other ships. And the longer you are on the water, the easier it is to recognize. But when you have a conversation with other ships, you can ask for his intentions, of course, over radio. And then...
No SOS? No,
it's all about communication.
Like, move over, buddy.
Because everybody has a target. When you know all targets, then you know what they're doing. And then you can go through. But it can be very busy on the rivers, especially on the Rhine rivers.
Right.
And when you go to the harbors where our ship is not going, like Rotterdam or Amsterdam, that's sometimes the Wild West.
Yeah.
Wow.
But well, we notice that, you know, oftentimes we're sailing all night long. We hope there are two of you. Is that the case? You're not working 24/7.
There are always two people in charge by the Nautic. One is driving, and the other guy is in charge for feeding and cafe.
Oh.
And we have to tie up the ships in the locks.
You have to tie them up?
Yeah, in the locks.
Mm.
So the sailor is also in charge for lining the ship, tied up, connected to the wall with a rope.
That sounds like an important job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's bringing us cafe or sandwich. And the good thing is from the locks that you always have a possibility to go to the toilet or make a walk. The locks take care that you don't fall, that you don't get tired because they're breaking. When you have a shift like 8 hours or 6 hours, and you just sit in the chair, but we have every hour one lock. You go outside because we draft the lock from outside. You get fresh air. You're moving, and you don't get tired.
Yeah. So you mentioned a little bit about your schedule. You're on how many weeks during the season?
A very luxury shift system, and you find that on all cargo ships as well in West Europe. That means the same amount of time you work, you can spend at home, not at one piece, but you can choose. Depends on your travel distance. So I work 2 weeks on, and I go home for 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That means that I have 6 months holiday a year.
Wow.
That's not correct. At home, I get mine.
your wife has a laundry list of things to
not
do?
Not a laundry list, but a honey-do list.
Oh, a honey-do list.
A honey-do list.
Do you have children at home?
Two.
Yeah. Two.
Yeah.
And where do you call home?
3 hours west from here.
In Germany.
3 hours by car in Germany, yes.
Oh, nice. So what besides honeydews do you do when you're home? Do you head to the Caribbean in the cold season?
Now when I go home, we do 2 weeks cruising with a German brand, AIDA. And we were looking for Florida and the Caribbean. But we changed our IDs because my children are a little bit small, 3 and 4. And we thought, let's do Florida when they are a little bit older, so they remember it. So now we do the Canary Islands.
Oh, Canary.
Madeira, Canary Islands, and Cap Verde.
Oh, nice.
It's been on my bucket list for sure.
But do you ever want to go on a cruise ship on your off time?
Of course.
Really?
I love cruising.
When somebody else is driving, right? And room service.
You don't have to worry about it.
I always go to the captain and say, I'm captain too. And he looks to me and I think, yeah, you are so young. No. No, I love cruising.
On a little more serious note, you know, with all that's going on in the world and, you know, the latest bombing in Paris, is there heightened security measures that Viking is taking or to keep the ship and passengers safer?
That's a difficult question because you're dealing with people you cannot plan. But of course, Viking have a lot of thoughts about safety, especially on this issue, because when something happened, then it could be the end of riverboat cruising in the first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a delicate question. And we had already a few issues, economic crisis, the internet bubble 2001, the volcano on Iceland in 2009, and they all made that the ships were empty for a period. So, Viking had a lot of touch.
Mm-hmm.
But so long there is no direct throw to our ships, the government will not take direct action to save the ships. There is no direct role.
Mm-hmm.
And Europe is still very safe.
Mm-hmm.
So, curiosity for us.
Have you ever had a stowaway on one of your journeys? Someone who has snuck on board and, you know, didn't pay. Not a paying passenger. And they
blind passenger.
Is that what it's called?
Blind passenger.
We call them stowaways.
They sort of hide in the corner.
They hide and they come out, you know.
We have every week blind passengers, small birds. And we had a dog one time.
But not human-like.
No.
Oh, you had a dog.
We had a dog one time.
Really?
Yeah, that's already a few years ago. And of course, they tried to keep him, but they want to make a shit dog from it.
Oh. But none of the human kind.
We brought him to the asyl.
The shelter.
Yeah. We have to bring him there.
Well, Captain Johan Bonds, we'll let you get back to driving this boat, which we know is kind of an important job. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
Your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
Your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
At age 37, Francis Lakey pursued his big dream. He set out to become the first person to summit the highest peak on every continent and surf every ocean. Over the next 12 years, he faced unexpected encounters with danger and death. They forever changed his perspective and his life. Francis recounts it all in his book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. We're delighted to have him here in our studios. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Francis, you're a professor of physics at Georgetown University. How did you come up with the idea that you dub surf and turf? And more importantly, why?
I first started climbing in my teens. I got on a surfboard in my 20s. And I realized in my 30s that I could actually be first at something. I could be the first person to summit the highest mountain in every continent, surf every ocean. And that's how it got started. I mean, it was completely shallow. I just wanted to be the first at something, and that's what I cooked up.
Well, I know this adventure really changed who you are. Tell us who you were. Who were you before you started this whole thing?
I'll give you the easy answer, which is I had these pillars. I had the foundations of my life, three things that I knew would never change about myself. So pillar number one, Francis Lakey would never get married. Pillar number two, Francis Lakey would never have kids. And then number three was I would never buy a house. I mean, those were things I was absolutely certain about. I didn't want any attachments whatsoever. And you ask me how I changed? Well, I am married. I have 3-year-old twin girls at home in a house that we own. So all of those pillars just tumbled. And it was all a result from this journey, you know, changing my perspective.
Well, Francis, I have to ask you, there's one part of your book at the beginning which was really kind of difficult to read. And maybe it's an example of your lack of attachments before you started your journey. You were climbing with a partner on El Capitan in Yosemite, and your partner's boots fell down the side of the mountain. But you still had your boots, and you could have gotten his boots and climbed back up. But instead, you basically kind of said, that sucks. And the guy climbed down the mountain, but his feet were very battered and bloody, and he really could have fallen down The Descent. And it was really painful to read.
Did you have to remind me of that? Yeah, that was. Can we just refer to that as the former Francis Slakey?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I admit a lot in this book, I think, to demonstrate to the reader the transformation that can happen as a result of a journey like this. I had to come clean on the kind of person that I was. And yeah, that was the kind of person I was. I was calloused, a little bit thick-skinned, iced over. I wasn't particularly sensitive. And in that example, you know, my climbing partner suffered a bit as a result of my not being attentive.
Are you still friends?
We are close friends.
Good.
Yeah, I think he was pleased that I've changed over the years, right? So now he knows if he gets into trouble, I'm going to be a more reliable partner than I was in the past.
Well, you must have had some kind of charm underneath, because honestly, I don't think I would have been your friend. No offense.
And he's very charming.
I understand that. It's look, I made up for it by being a decent climber, and that's the reason why I had climbing partners.
Well, let's talk about your adventure a bit. Your surf and turf list really took you to Mount Everest, which was just amazing to read about. And you got stuck in a blizzard on the summit, and you had to make some very difficult life and death decisions. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, you guys don't ask any softball questions, do you?
We're the two boomer babes, Francis.
Yeah, so that was one of the turning points in my life, and the circumstances were I was on the summit, but it was near whiteout conditions. So it was 40 below zero in a blizzard. I couldn't see more than 20 feet in any direction. And I turn around to head back, and I am just exhausted. I mean, one thing you learn when you're climbing is you have plenty of adrenaline when you're going up. Turn around and go down, all the adrenaline just drains away. So I was exhausted, and it would be slow going, so I slowly work my way down that ridgeline. It's just three breaths and a step, just step, step, and I'm slowly working my way down that ridgeline, and then I see ahead of me in the storm, there's three climbers, and they're talking. I can't hear what they're saying because the wind is just howling. And I can just barely make him out because I can only see about 20 feet in the whiteout. And then suddenly one of them sits down and the other two keep on going. And in those kind of conditions, at that altitude, sitting down could only mean one thing, that whoever just sat down decided to die. And confronting that situation I mean, you can't come away from a situation like that being the same person that you were.
So did the person die?
He survived. And he survived because of the quick thinking. As it turned out, one of my climbing buddies also arrived on the scene roughly about the same time I did. And it's funny, we didn't even see each other in the storm, but there we were, the three of us, the sitting climber, me, my climbing partner, and we knew, you know, however this was going to play out, our lives would be entwined forever. And my climbing partner just he carried some Dex. It's like speed, dexamethadrin, and he managed to get that sitting climber to take that speed. We had no idea what the right quantity was. You know, we just sort of guessed at the right amount, and it was enough to get him up on his feet and get him moving again.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we are talking with Georgetown physics professor Francis Slakey about his quest to be the first to summit the highest peak on every continent and surf every ocean. Francis, you were telling us about this Mount Everest adventure. You were also given an amulet before you went on this journey, took on a great meaning when you got back. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, let me tell you how it started. So the Sherpas on our expedition had said that we should stop into a monastery and get a blessing on the way up. And they said it's going to bring us good luck and we should do it. And as it turns out, the monastery that they wanted us to get the blessing in has a lama who they believe is a reincarnate. So they believe he's been around for 300 years. So I thought, all right, fine, I'll go in and get my blessing, and while I'm there, I'll ask him a question. I'll ask him, what's the meaning of life? So
that's
we all
a short answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. And
give us his business card.
Yeah.
Well, so what I got was this amulet. So I asked my question. He has a translator, so he actually doesn't speak English. So he had a translator sitting beside him, and I got my blessing, and then I asked my question, what's the meaning of life? And the translator whispers it to the lama, and the lama thinks about it, and then whispers back to the translator, and the translator says, You guys ready for this? Translator says, he'll get back to you on that.
Oh, that's like a wizard of Oz.
He deferred the question.
I thought I got just, you know, the blow off. And later that night, I went to my tent, and a young monk showed up with a little bundle. And when I unwrapped the bundle, inside of it was an amulet, and etched onto the amulet were these letters. And at the time, I just sort of shrugged it off. I didn't pay much attention to it. But I tell you, by the end of my journey, the last few years of my journey, I became obsessed with translating the letters on that amulet.
And what did they say?
Well, people have to read the book to find out.
Oh, come on. Cliffhanger.
There's
cliffhanger.
There's no place like home.
That's right. Well, was there ever a time on your adventures where you said to yourself, what the heck have I done? I'm gonna die.
So, no, not really. It may not seem this way when you read the book, but I'm actually very careful with my risks, you know. And yeah, I have this mantra. You don't need a parachute to skydive. You need a parachute to skydive twice.
Oh, right. Yes.
So my view is, you know.
Because when you hit the ground, that's really
that's
a bummer.
Maybe that was on the ambulance.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I have every intention of coming back in one piece. I got a lot to live for. So I manage my risks very carefully. What you see in the book, you know, sometimes things get ahead of me, and there's things that I didn't plan for. You know, the blizzard I didn't plan for, or the car accident in Morocco. I mean, there's things that are just outside of my control. And that's where it seems like it gets risky. But the stuff that I can control, I try to manage it really carefully. Now, was that convincing?
Very convincing.
Okay,
yeah, kind of.
Francis, during your adventures, the part I also, the very positive part in your book, there's lots of positive parts, but how you began to realize that everything is intertwined, and as you say, one unending ball of thread. And an example of that was meeting your wife on Mount Everest, even though you found out she actually lived a few blocks away from you in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
So does the physics professor in you leave a little bit of room for faith these days?
It was hard to explain some of the, what the reader will see, just how many improbable things happen throughout the course of the book. And one of them, like you said, is meeting my wife in Mount Everest and discovering that she actually lived in Washington, D.C., three metro stops away from me. But we played in different circles, and so we would never have actually met unless we both happened to go to Everest at precisely the same time on the same expedition, which was pure coincidence. And I remember calculating the odds of that. And the odds are more than 1,000,000 to 1 that we would overlap. And my explanation was just how intertwined we all are. You know, there's various ways to look at that, some spiritual, some religious. But the fact is, we are intertwined. Our lives are wrapped together in ways that are totally unexpected.
So do you think it was fate? We think it was fate.
Yeah.
That's a great love story, Francis.
Oh, look, my wife would swear by it. She swears by fate. But that's continuing frustration with her that I'm just not saying the word that I accept at all.
Well, any plans in the works for a next big physical challenge?
You know, the next thing is raising these twin girls.
Oh, that's a big challenge.
Wow.
I mean,
yeah, that's my Everest right now.
And especially girls.
So at night, do you just sort of sit back and watch Survivor on TV? I mean, thank God you're not on some snowy mountain somewhere. That's what I would do, actually.
You know, what we're looking forward to now is the time when the kids get a little bit older and we can start taking them to some of the places that we went. Certainly where my wife and I met on Everest, one of the most spectacular places in the world. We want to take the kids back there. But, you know, one of the monks we met, a lama that we met along the way, had a lot of influence on my life. And I actually named one of our kids after the lama, Kinley. And so we'd love to take her back and meet her namesake, too. So we have a lot of trips in mind.
Well, Francis Slakey, author of To the Last Breath, a memoir of going to extremes, thanks so much for sharing your incredible adventures with the two Boomer Babes. I'm going to get packing.
Up next, we'll shoot the breeze with a boomer who has taken the pub crawl to a whole new level.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Hey,
had to happen sometime, and now it's the latest craze in Chicago and more than two dozen U.S. cities.
It's described as part spin class, part pub crawl, and part parade. It's cycling merged with bar hopping. The result? A pub on wheels for 16 adventurous revelers. Al Boyce is the owner of Pedal Pub. He joins us on the phone from Minneapolis to shoot the breeze with the babes. Pleasure to have you on the show, Al.
Pleased to meet you, ladies.
Okay, Al, explain what this contraption looks like. What are we talking about here?
Well, it's a if you can imagine a bar, an in-the-round bar with seats, six seats on each side, and a bench for three in the back, and it's probably about the size of a van, and it's all pedal powered.
Wow! Now, how does it work? Do they peddlers actually, you know, imbibe on the pedal pub, or stop at bars along the way and take carryouts? What's the deal?
Well, it's not strictly beer anymore, actually, it's beer or wine. We actually are working on a deal in St. Petersburg, Florida, teaming up with a company called Eat, Sip, Indulge to make it a gourmet food tour as well. So, yes, we stop along the way. If alcohol is permitted on board in your locality, then we allow that, but it's very much dependent on the location.
Well, how much does a tour cost?
In the Twin Cities, it's $380 for a two-hour tour on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah,
so
for 16. Okay.
Right, so it works out to be about $25 a person.
Okay. I would think that's a lot of drinks for one person. Okay.
But that doesn't include the drinks, I don't think, right?
Right.
That's just
in Minneapolis,
the bicycle.
In Minneapolis, is a location where we are allowed to have beer and wine on board, and people do bring their own.
Oh. Right. Well, Al, I assume there's a company-provided driver, I mean someone who knows what they're actually doing and who stays sober?
Exactly. Yep.
And what does this driver do? Do they give you, you know, directions about pedal, 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 stop? What do they do?
All of that, certainly. We call them pilots, actually, to make it alliterative, pedal pub pilots, of course. And they provide, besides providing the encouragement you mentioned, they go over a list of rules of do's and don'ts before the tour. They're responsible for keeping it safe, and they stay in close contact with the renter throughout the tour to make sure that the tour is safe and fun for everyone.
Well, Al, what happens when too many people get too drunk to pedal?
Tour's over.
Oh! What about the motor? Don't you have one to get them home?
No motor, no, but strictly pedal powered.
No motor.
Yeah, we find that in 2 hours, that's just about the right amount of time to, you know, have fun and yet not get too crazy.
Well, who are your customers?
Oddly enough, we find that our customer is not what you might think is, you know, the younger 18 to 35. It's actually 35 to 50-year-old women.
Oh, really? Oh, it sounds like
true.
Boomer babes. Hey.
Exactly, yep. That's
well, we
market.
Like a good time.
Exactly.
We're not to say that that's strictly all who the peddlers are, but it's that age group that seems to do the renting and seems to do the organizing.
We let the men do the peddling, right?
There you go.
We sit back and relax and drink. Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, I would think the combo of biking and drinking could definitely have its dangers. Does everyone come back alive from this venture?
Absolutely, yes. In 6 years that we've been running, we do carry a very large insurance policy, and it's never had a claim.
Wow.
Oh.
Well, you know, Al, tell us what lures people to try it out.
Well, just describing it on the radio is really not sufficient. It's really seeing it and doing it better yet. So most of our people are doing it, coming back as returning riders or returning renters or somebody who has heard it from word of mouth or somebody who has seen it. I encourage everybody to go to pedalpub.com to take a look at it. Once you see it online, find some city that has it and take a look at it and hopefully take a ride on it.
Well, Al Boyce, owner of Pedal Pub, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the Two Boomer Babes. We're going to book a trip.
Thank you very much. We look forward to it.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.